Welcome to The Jury Is Out, a podcast for trial attorneys who want to sharpen their skills and better serve their clients. Your co-hosts are John Simon, founder of the Simon Law Firm, Tim Cronin, personal injury trial attorney at the Simon Law Firm, and St. Louis attorney Eric Veith.
Welcome to another episode of The Jury Is Out. I'm Tim Cronin.
I'm Johnny Simon.
I'm John Simon.
So, gentlemen, we've been talking about, and we're going to continue talking about your recent trial in the Chaplin case versus Geiger, Coff & Cardinal, and United Brands. We went through kind of what happened in the case, the development, and kind of piecing it together in discovery. But one thing I haven't asked you yet is, can you tell me about the clients?
Wonderful. You know, like, I don't think I've ever had...
What are their names?
Karen and Jason. So Jason and Karen. Jason Polite and Karen Chaplin. They're Marissa's mother and father, and they are wonderful. And, you know, I thought what was awesome about them, one of the best aspects was they shared three children together. They were divorced at the time of trial, but they were, like, met when they were 14 or 13.
Best friends.
And they're best friends. I mean, they're divorced. They don't, you know, they're not married to one another, but they were best friends, and they were there for each other during this whole tragedy, you know, and both were on the same page, no fighting at all about anything. And they were just people who were, you know, egregiously harmed by all parties involved and want to do the right thing and help other people.
I mean, just unspeakable harm. You can't even contemplate what they have gone through and what they're going through. And the thing that they both shared was their absolute devotion to this case and this cause. And at every turn, this is something that the more they learned about it, the more determined they were to see it through, and just terrific, just wonderful.
Now, John, you put both of them on the stand?
Yes.
I caught some of the trial. Eric and I were getting ready to try another case, so we were busy here. But on one of the days in the first week, I think, of your trial, Eric and I were out in the same courthouse for a pretrial, so we stopped in and watched some of it. And I caught the tail end of Dad's testimony and then the beginning of United Brands owners and corporate representatives' deposition that was played, and the dichotomy of that was striking. But as I understand it, did you sandwich that corporate rep depo in between both of the clients?
Yeah, we did.
What was the approach you took in putting them on the stand?
I think the best way to frame what the defendant did is not just the defendant's conduct, but the consequences of that conduct. You know, it's like, you know, when you try a case, sometimes, you know, you put the liability on and then you put the damages on. And we really wanted to show that here's their conduct, but here's what their conduct has caused.
And how they feel about it, you know. And the punitive damages claim, the standard is a conscious disregard for safety or a complete indifference. And showing, I think it highlighted the indifference of United Brands and how people perceived it because of where he went in the trial. I mean, he went in sandwiched between Jason and Karen.
The dad was breaking down on the stand at the end of his testimony.
He did fantastic.
He did a wonderful job. And
so did Karen. They both did a great job.
Breaking down and saying, when I remember saying, this has to stop. This cannot happen again.
That was the last question that I asked him was, why you had to, you know, go through this you know, heart-wrenching stuff for 2 weeks, and now you're pouring your heart out to 14 strangers. Why on earth are you doing this?
Yeah.
And his answer, I mean, said it all, that what he had learned in throughout the case, that Marissa wasn't the first one, but he was going to do everything he could to make sure she was the last one.
And then juxtaposed against the indifference shown by the United Brands owner and corporate representative. And just kind of to set the stage, John, you did voir dire in the case, right?
Yes.
And I want to go through that and kind of ask about a focus group you guys did in advance of the trial. And Johnny, you did opening and closing, correct?
Yes.
And you had worked up, you had a knowledge of all the documents and worked up a lot of the liability.
Kind of how we split it was my dad took on voir dire and the damages, which if you're not incorporating damages into every witness and the liability, I mean, you're not doing it right. But my dad took on the first responders, the issue of Well, there were two levels.
Establishing the chain that he did the drug and bought.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we decided that my dad would do the parents just because he's closer in age to them, connected way better. And your original question is, how did you approach it? And even though their testimony was 20 minutes, I think I watched my dad prep for that testimony and evaluate it 25 hours conservatively. I mean, that's like work that I observed.
And let me just say, it wasn't spending all of that time with them to figure out what they needed to say. It was me spending all of that time with them so that I knew them better. You know, I knew who they were. The more time I spent with them, the more I liked them. The more I learned about them, the more I understood about what, you know, what they're going through. And I'm telling you, with both of them, it was, it didn't even matter what the questions were. I mean, it really didn't. We made an effort to, from every minute that we were in the courtroom, every minute we were in the building, to recognize the seriousness of what we were doing. And to us, it was a mission. And with our clients, it was a mission. And we never lost focus of why we were there and what we were trying to do.
So we have attorney meetings, and sometimes we have like mini continuing legal education classes for each other. And during COVID, I forget what the topic was, but you boiled down like all of our goals and what we do to two basic rules. Make the defendant look bad. Make the plaintiffs look good. And so you...
Brilliant.
You, well, keep things simple. You made the plaintiffs look good. And in between that, Johnny, what was your job?
Make the defendants look bad.
Tell me about Mr. Zaharia, who owns United Brands, and what happened in his depo that you played between these two parents that lost their child.
So you can't really make this up. Mr. Zaharia, Nasser Zaharia, he is the CEO and owner of United Brands and has been since the early 2000s. In the early 2000s, there was a nationwide drug like bust, or it was called Operation Pipe Dreams. And essentially what happened is John Ashcroft, who was the attorney general at the time, led a nationwide sting against the online sellers of drug paraphernalia. You know, it's early 2000s, the internet's coming up, and operations are starting to sell bongs, pipes, one-hitters, cocaine, freebase kits on the internet, which exploded. And so Mr. Ashcroft didn't like that, and so there was a sting against, I think it was 73 or 63 individuals, of which Mr. Zaharia was one.
The owner of United Brands thereafter.
Yes, who at the time was running a head shop. Or a smoke shop, what he called a...
quote. That's interesting, because I remember for this depo you played that he said he didn't know what one of those was.
That's correct. He called it a lifestyle store, which I still don't...
Yeah.
I think everyone can imagine what kind of lifestyle store it was. But he started it and was actually selling nitrous at his, quote, lifestyle store, and turned around starting United Brands and start...
Between there, he got convicted.
Yes.
And was a felon.
Yes, he pled guilty to a federal felony for conspiring to sell drug paraphernalia, which is what we allege that he did in this case through United Brands.
Which brings up that you didn't just have product liability claims, you also had a conspiracy claim in this trial, which you succeeded on.
Yes, and a civil conspiracy is an agreement between two or more parties to do something unlawful or illegal. You don't have to prove illegality, you just have to prove an underlying tort. And we alleged a conspiracy between United Brands and Coffin Cardinal, which, you know, it's not something that attorneys run into very often. No one really understands, you know, the significance of it or the use of it. And it really does allow you to get in to, you know, statements that you otherwise might not get in, or, you know, hold people jointly and severally liable for one another's conduct.
It's basically like civil RICO. Giuliani... we'll ignore what has happened with him in his later life, helped bring down the mob is through RICO actions, because if you can tie them all to one organization, they're all good for every crime any member of that conspiracy committed. And in civil cases.
Right. It's what brought big tobacco. You know, one of the things I did to prepare for opening and close is I got and reviewed all of the big tobacco openings and closings that I could find, get my hands on. And, you know, because they had a civil, that is what brought big tobacco down. Let me put it this way. It brought big tobacco having to pay some money to people who they addicted and caused to have cancer and die.
Yeah.
But they created the American Tobacco Institute, right? And they were a non-party. They didn't sell anything. They just published a lot of information.
Yeah, we'll call it disinformation.
Yeah, disinformation, lies.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were communications that were, they allowed, were able to get into evidence as statements of a co-conspirator because they alleged a conspiracy between the two. And, you know, reading that, it was so interesting to see, you know, the kind of the kingpin or the drug dealer and how they, you know, framed it. That was really interesting.
So tell me, I imagine you had a lot of questions for Mr. Zaharia, the CEO and owner of United Brands. Did you play about 4 hours of deposition testimony in your case?
Well, I knew from the last case that because of the, you know, egregiousness of the conduct, that there was a chance that Mr. Zaharia was never going to be in the courtroom. And so I had to take, you know, a trial deposition using all of the exhibits that we're wanting to get into evidence, lay a foundation. It was very technical. I also had to be very patient, from which you know that I'm not, and, you know, deal with a lot of answers and non-answers.
And nonsense objections.
Nonsense objections, but it was just really a fight. I mean, there were I think in the beginning of his depo, he said he could not authenticate his own deposition from the last case.
I watched like 15 to 20 minutes of what you played right after the dad had gone on the stand. And again, that dichotomy was like striking. And every single question you asked him, you knew you weren't going to get a straight answer, and you were prepared to pull up a document, prior sworn testimony with the page in line ready, or their own documents that you got from the other case or this case. To every single admission you got from the man, you had to pry from him by presenting him with undeniable prior testimony or documents from his company to get him to finally acknowledge. And even then, he still didn't.
And that's, I was going to say that. And that, I think, is the turning point in the, you know, what makes it a complete indifference, or, you know, you really want to anger the 12 people who have to sit there through that. Is, you know, they're seeing it with their own eyes, and you're still denying. I think there was a point where, you know, there was an email sent. I don't think this came into evidence because we didn't need it, but it was an email sent from Mr. Zaharia to someone else, and he said, I'd never sent that email. And I was like, well, I mean, is this your email address? And he's like, yeah, but I don't send my own emails. And there was a tag that said it's from his iPhone.
Yeah.
Like someone happened to have your, like, iPhone sending emails for you? I mean, that's a little strange.
So didn't he come in and, in response to all kinds of things that he shouldn't have said this for, say, I don't have an opinion on that?
Yeah, he had been prepared, I guess by his lawyers, to say he didn't have opinions concerning...
What kinds of things? Give me some examples.
Things that any decent human being would have opinions about, like... Should his company be selling nitrous oxide into the inhalation market?
Should you sell drugs to children?
should you be poisoning kids?
He would say, I don't have an opinion on that.
I don't have an opinion. I mean, it was an hour of, I don't have an opinion. I don't have an opinion. I don't have an opinion on repeat about, you know.
Was there a ruling on that, on being able to ask him? A standard of care sort of questions.
Right, before his deposition.
Right, and I think that was the reason for the I don't have an opinion, because I think the court had already ruled that you're allowed to ask those questions and he needs to answer them.
We had to run up to court the day before the depo because I received an email. It was an email that said, Mr. Zaharia will not be giving opinions in his deposition. So we had to go up to court and I said, Judge, you know, I have his deposition. He's given opinions before. You know, he's under oath and has to.
We're talking about what a reasonable owner of a company would do when considering selling nitrous oxide to head shops.
And you think about...
He's qualified to give opinions.
And you know, he disqualified or tried to disqualify himself by saying, I'm not an expert in how these things should be marketed and sold. It made him look ridiculous. And that became an issue at the pretrial. It was, you know, what relevance is the fact that he doesn't have opinions? And, you know, he doesn't have an opinion about it. How does that
He doesn't
work?
Have an opinion about what reasonable conduct should be for a company like his.
Sure. And I said, Judge, I mean, number one, he's bound by that. Number two...
Right. So the lawyer can't argue
It's incredibly relevant.
What they think is or isn't reasonable.
To prove a complete indifference if he doesn't have an opinion about the harm his conduct's causing.
Yeah.
But it was like, I think it was about 45 minutes about, you know, whether or not he has opinions about something. Is he really going to say he doesn't have an opinions about the harm nitrous oxide causes people?
Yeah.
I mean, it was mind-boggling.
Going into trial, you guys did a focus group, right?
A couple
focus groups.
What were your
biggest concerns going in that you may have tested with focus groups? What were you worried about? Reasons you might lose?
I think what turned out to be the biggest issue that was confirmed by the focus groups was some people's inability to even consider a case against a company who sold a product to another company, who sold it to a young man who inhaled it and drove over.
Knowingly and voluntarily.
Knowingly and voluntarily.
With a warning on the box that said, do not inhale.
Yeah. I mean, it was with a lot of people, it was, you know, you don't go past go. I mean, that was the beginning and the end.
And what we found out is, you know, people don't have a lot of experience with this drug, nitrous oxide, but they have a lot of experience with other substances. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're really not comparable, but all of the people who couldn't go there were comparing it to alcohol, comparing it to...
It's like Sue and Anheuser-Busch.
Exactly. Yes. I mean, you just kept seeing over and over... This is, remember, the Tide Pods.
So that's what I want. This is a major issue. You have to take care of it in voir dire and find those people and get them off. How'd you do it?
Well, we thought a lot about it, talked about it, and it's like how we normally approach any voir dire, and that is, you know, your worst issue or your top, you know, two worst issues, you got to hit it head on. And what I thought of doing here was to really underplay, you know, the case and actually, you know, feed into the whole concept of we're not going there. And I think what we ended up doing was, you know, just basically asking in the beginning. And as a matter of fact, I was at a point very early in the voir dire. I hadn't gotten to that point yet.
I understand someone brought it up.
Someone brought it up on their own, right. And so, for instance, I'm 5 pages ahead of where I'm at.
Like,
I'm going to ask.
Does anybody know these police officers?
Yeah,
I'm asking
if anybody knows the police officers. And some gentleman stood up and said, Mr. Simon, I don't know the police officers, but I can tell you this: you ain't going to get anything from me. Your life's on any kind
of. He was a liquor store owner.
Right. He said, I owned a liquor store. And he said, and let me just tell you, I've got sued multiple times for things I sold. I didn't have anything to do with how somebody used it or what they were doing. And he said, I just can't. And he was polite about it.
Oh, sure.
But he just said, I cannot under any circumstances be on this case because I won't find for you no matter what.
Which really helped. He was nice and reasonable.
He was nice and reasonable. And then that opened the floodgates.
Doctors on the panel at MedMal cases.
Yeah, yeah. So, no, not so anyway, and
so
then
what'd you do? Skip 12 pages?
Yeah. Actually, I told everybody. I said, we're putting this down. You know, we'll put this outline down. And I said, if I only had 15 minutes, this is the only thing I would talk to you guys about. And I just put the outline down and said, who else feels that way? And we started on one, you know, in the box. And
this is after they understood. Talking about the manufacturer and distributor and then the retailer.
Yes. And at that point, no one knew whether it was for inhalation or not. How it was marketed. And also nobody knew about the warning on the box. And I was saving the warning on the box for some people who were maybe on the fence a little bit. And so we went through, and the amazing thing, it really wasn't amazing, it was somewhat, you know, predictable. The people who there was nobody on the fence. People had strong feelings or they didn't.
It's about identifying,
right,
getting them to say.
Yes, and so none of them were shy about it. I mean, they really weren't. They, you know, they would, and it was a matter of, there were 80 people on the panel that came in, and I literally asked that question to every single person, all 80, and it went pretty quick because.
What was the, so I originally, you had asked me about it, and I said, I came up with a question that you said was too good.
Well, you know what? No, here's the thing. Sometimes
disagreement.
It was the warning. Read the warning on the box that says "Do not inhale."
Yours was with the warning.
Yeah, he inhaled the product. Now we're suing the company.
Right.
What was your exact question?
Well,
to all 80 people.
My lesson here is don't try to put too fine a point on any question in voir dire because you're gonna go places that you didn't think they were going to go, right? They're going to rephrase your question and take you different places. And it just got to the point of, look, this person inhaled something, passed out, and drove through a building and killed somebody. And now we're suing the company that sold it to the company that sold it to him. And that was it. I didn't talk about a warning. And people were like, no, not going there. And I, it was so, like, it easy.
It almost got to the personal responsibility thing. The hard part about our legal system, I think, is, you know, the law considers alternative causes. The law requires folks to, you know, actually consider the fault of everyone, contribute how much they contributed. And, you know, we don't generally do that.
It's funny. One of the jurors in Voir dire raised that and said, no, wait a minute. Can we assess fault?
Yeah, right.
And then I said, I think you're going to be given an instruction to assess fault between all three defendants. And people were like a sigh of relief going, oh, okay.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
He was a younger guy with tattoos, and he goes, if I can assess fault between the parties, I'm good.
Yeah, right. So, but it was funny because we're going through this, and I think there were 26 or 27 people who were pretty clear that they couldn't consider,
no matter what the law is.
Doesn't matter what the evidence is, we can't consider at all a claim against United Brands. And they were all gone, and they couldn't be rehabilitated. I mean, they were just gone.
I mean, they were saying, doubling down so hard.
And you're never getting any money from me, no matter.
The plaintiff is not going to win the case.
Yeah.
Right, and that's what it was. And then the other folks, it made it easy because all I would say is, can you stick around and listen to the evidence?
Yeah.
And they would go, sure. And that's kind of what we were left with.
So then you want to see just how open-minded the remaining people are, and you had a particular example to illustrate it, right?
So one of the things that I was debating whether I should do this or not, but I just
remember you did your practice session. I didn't like it.
Well,
must have done it differently.
It was much different.
But here was the thing. Let me just tell you my thinking in deciding whether or not to do it. I had already gotten through the entire 80 people and identified 26 or 27, and clearly where they were going, they were leaving, and so the next issue was, these people, even the ones that were still there, didn't nobody liked the case. Yeah. I mean, nobody. Everybody who was still there who didn't say, I can't find, you know, for the plaintiff.
You want to see if they can think about it a little differently.
Right. And what I wanted to do was condition a little bit, frame it a little bit, but I didn't want to undo what I had done getting the folks off.
Yeah.
And so I brought up the Tide Pods challenge. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure some of the people listening to this knows, you know, have heard of that. I was surprised because more than half of the hands went up when I asked about it in Dern Voir dire.
I heard when you brought up the Tide Pod Challenge, there was a sigh in the courtroom.
Yeah, well, it was.
I didn't know where you were going.
There was a sigh, and then I picked one of the panel members who ended up being on our jury.
Yeah.
And I picked her, and she was four person, very favorable. I could tell she was with us, and I directed it right at her and said, so everybody's heard, have you heard of the pod, you know, challenge where kids, you know, eat it and they videotape it, they put it on online, or maybe some little toddlers end up swallowing or eating it. And I said to the juror, I said, now if a 4-year-old ate one of these and got really sick or died, should Procter & Gamble be held responsible? And she was with us and said, absolutely not. And I said, I agree. That would be ridiculous. Does everybody agree? That's ridiculous. And people were waving their hands, and everybody in the room thought it was ridiculous to hold them responsible. And then I said, okay, let me change it a little bit. What if they sold them in candy stores? And like everybody was like,
their eyes, like, I get it. And
so she said that would be crazy. I think she even said that would be criminal.
Yeah.
You know, like they should be put in jail or something. And I said, well, what about this? What if they took the videos of the teenagers doing the challenge and posted it on their website?
That's how they market.
How about
the product should be?
And then I know what I asked. I said, so what you're saying is, no matter what the circumstances are, how you market it matters.
Yeah.
And everybody kind of agreed how you market it. So I kind of let them know. And then after that, I think it was after that, one of the panel members raised their hand and said, are you supposed to inhale this? They didn't even know you're supposed to inhale it.
Yeah.
And I said, well, no, there's a warning on the box that says don't inhale it. And then another woman said, well,
why are they selling this in smoke shops?
Yeah.
And she did that on her own.
Counsel for United Brands wouldn't answer that question.
I said, I'm sorry, you're going to have, you know, Mr. Morris is going to have to answer that.
Yeah.
I said, I'm sure he'll answer that for you.
Yeah.
So, no, it was.
I mean, and that's really what the case then was about. Why are they selling this in Edge?
Yeah, and I'm telling you, how many people asked that in Vordar when the defense attorney was up?
I couldn't believe. I've been practicing, I think this is 8 years, 9 years, and I've never seen a jury reach the essence without being told about what the case is about. Like, they just cut through all the wheat from chaff and asked the question to both parties. They were like, okay, why is this happening? To the point where he'd ask a question, you know, the defense attorney would ask a question about something completely different, and they'd go, yeah, I understand that, but why are you selling this in head shops? Like, repeatedly, over and over. It was frustrating people because he wasn't answering it, and he kept saying, I can't answer it.
The answer is money.
Yeah, money, right.
So he couldn't answer the question. It's kind of what the case was about.
Yeah.
You know what? That money.
I'm telling you that the question that the panel member asked, why are they selling it at smoke shops?
Yeah.
Because that was the one that
now
said.
Now you all
no, it was the same panel member, and she said, I got a question. Are you supposed to inhale it? And I said, no. And then she said, well, why in the world are they selling it at head shops?
One of the jurors who made the panel, it was a male man, and I think it was the first person that Mr. Morris, the attorney from United Brands, called on. Because he was kind of on the fence with causation, you know, contributed to cause, the warning. He didn't like the warning being on the box and the kid inhaling it. And he goes, you've said something. First question, I think, was directed to him. And he goes, yeah, I understand there's a warning, but why are you selling it at head shops? And what we learned from our focus groups is that issue cuts both ways. It's bad that it's on the box, but it also shows intent. The focus group response for most people, the people who were with us anyway,
they said that just shows that it's intentional.
There's like five different exhibits or documents that are quote-unquote warnings that we said were CYA documents, cover your ass documents. And every person who was with us was using the documents to prove intent. Every person who wasn't with us was using the documents to like immunize them from liability.
The focus of the evidence on liability for United Brands was they knew exactly what they were selling this for. They knew it's dangerous, despite them not admitting it right now. Were there any other main focuses of what you were trying to show about what United Brands knew or what they did?
You know, it was a marketing case, a marketing and sales case, because it's promotion of the product. It's one thing to put it in places where you know it's going to be used a certain way. I think it gets you there on the strict liability claim, is putting it in the stream of commerce as an inhalant renders it defective and unreasonably dangerous. That was our position. The second part, though, was what they did to promote it and in the face of what they knew was hurting people.
Yeah, I mean, that's the heat for punitive damages, which you had a punitive damages.
Sure.
I think it's all defendants.
I thought we should get a directed verdict on a punitive damages claim.
Yeah, that's always a dangerous thing to do. It's better to turn it over to the jury. I can say that once you win.
Yeah, right.
So wasn't there a marketing person put on the stand?
So in their case, they called a few different witnesses, one of which was their vice president of marketing, who I had deposed, and she was a nice person, kind of a contrast between Mr. Zaharia and her. I mean, you could tell that she had some remorse about what they were doing, mm-hmm. to the point where she admitted to me in her deposition that United Brands has, quote, no business marketing or selling nitrous oxide to head shops.
I imagine she had to take the position, so we're not doing it anymore.
Yeah, right. So we're really not doing it because I don't know if those are smoke shops or head shops. I'm just a marketing person.
Yeah.
I'm not a salesperson. You'd have to ask them. But the jury had already seen all the shops and who they're selling to.
Right.
I think what happened is the defense lawyer put her on. It was sort of like setting the table for me. You know, they've seen like all of these smoke shops and the amounts that they're selling to individual smoke shops. And repeatedly, when they said, we're not selling it, there's evidence they're continuing to sell it. And then he put her on for about 20 minutes talking about, they pulled up one ad, and Johnny had put up like dozens of ads showing that they're in marketing it for inhalation and recreational use and inhalation. And so he puts up a chef, wasn't it, an advertisement for
it? It was on their website, and I guess they promote on their website that they partner with gourmet chefs. I'm not really sure.
Which they may. I mean, they may, you know, I'm not doubting they don't do that.
Sure.
But
they also sell it to head shops to be used as an inhalant.
So yeah. One of the first thing.
Who aren't usually exclusive.
Yeah. The first thing I did was put up an ad from you. And I said, did you use this yet?
Highlighted it said for breathtaking experiment.
And you don't I asked Johnny, is this their ad?
Yeah.
He goes, yeah. So I pop it up there, and what did it show? What it had?
It was Naughty Whip,
woman laying on the ground
with whipped cream
covering on her breasts, and it said something about do this breathtaking experience.
That's for bakeries, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, that's what I asked. I popped it up and said, "Is this ad for the coffee clients, or is it for the
food
clients?"
Is that for Starbucks?
Right. That's Starbucks. I think she's a very nice lady, and I think she was honest in her deposition. I mean, she was critical of the company, but she kept on her own just. Not apologizing, but saying, we don't do it anymore. We don't sell it to them anymore. We don't sell it. And finally, I said, why do you keep saying that? Is it because it is so bad and horrible for any company to do that you couldn't conceive of any company who would intentionally do that, right?
Yeah.
She agreed.
And what should happen is...
And I said, what should we do with a company that does that intentionally, that markets this for inhalation? Should they be put out of business? And I don't... Do you remember what she said? She sort of halfway agreed with me.
Yeah.
I think she did. She agreed, yeah, they should be, you know, put out of business.
They should be shut down.
They should be shut down.
And then if I'm correct, you asked a couple questions that set up my favorite part of the case. Didn't you ask her, so if I walk, drive my pickup truck?
I said, if I go out tonight and get in my pickup and drive around to head shops in the St. Louis area, I shouldn't find any Whippets on the shelves. And she said, no, not you shouldn't, unless they're like 3 or 4 years old in inventory.
Yeah.
Or 3 years old. You shouldn't find any on the shelves.
So there was a couple day delay during the trial for reasons we won't get into. But you get the next day you get back to the trial, you're going to do closing arguments. But you had some more evidence you wanted to put on, right?
Some rebuttal.
What'd you do?
So we hired an investigator after the first weekend break. The case went into a second week, and we heard an opening statement from the defense attorney. Very clearly that we do not sell to head shops. We haven't sold to head shops in 3 years. We haven't made any sales since 2020. He repeatedly said that throughout the case. His witnesses stated that in their depositions and live. So over the weekend, we hired an investigator to go out to head shops and buy Whippets. And so it was a Labor Day weekend, we had a three-day weekend, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and he went to about 30 shops, and he bought boxes of Whippets from 26 of the 30, and the four that he couldn't get them from, they were out, but they were expecting shipments, you know, coming next
week.
They
were United Brands Whippets.
They were United Brands Whippets. The shelves were stacked with them.
Did you bring them all in?
Yeah, we did. He bought about 10 boxes from each shop. So what we did is when United Brands closed their case, the judge asked if we had any rebuttal. I said, one witness, Your Honor, and we presented the investigator. We put him on the stand. The first thing I did was put up a slide of the opening statement of the defense attorney.
We don't do it.
Where he said, we do not sell, and he repeated that two or three times all in the same slide. And then I said, who are you? And did we hire you? Mm-hmm. When did we hire you? What did we ask you to do? And then at the right time, while he was on the stand, we opened up a folding table right in front of the jury box, and then wheeled in three tubs of the nitrous oxide boxes from 26 different stores. And each one was in a plastic bag we had set up, and the receipt was stapled to the outside of the bag, which made it kind of easy, so we could just show them the bag and where did you get it and how many. And and then we started laying them out on the table, and I did that for, 10 minutes or so, filled up half the table.
The nail in the coffin.
Well, anyway, we just kept stacking them up, and it got to the point I was afraid the table was going to collapse because they're kind of heavy. So I finally just said, I'm not going to go through any more with you.
That was the last thing before close.
Well, right? No, actually, it was some cross-examination. Throughout the case, we had presented evidence that, you know, that when they say they're not doing it, they're still doing it. If they are still doing it through distributors that they own or control or whatever, but they're still selling smoke shops and head shops. And so defense counsel got up and
established that they're using a middleman?
And no, he just said... there's no paper trail that you could show.
He used those words.
Paper trail. And everybody was like, what? a paper trail. No, there's no paper trail that they can connect them.
Yeah.
And then he pointed
over to make sure there's not a paper trail. I think they're called drug dealers.
Yeah, you know what? It reminded me of The Dark Knight where the Joker is going, let me go. And he goes, very poor choice of words.
Yeah. Yeah.
As he said that, I was like, paper trail. Well,
one of the other things he did was, I think it was the last question, he pointed up to the screen with his statement saying, we don't sell it anymore. We haven't for 3 years. And he said, you can't say that's untrue, can you? And the guy said, well, no, not really.
I imagine you had some fun in closing argument, Johnny.
Paper trail, I mean, isn't that the point? They still don't get it.
They still don't get it. Yeah. So you have a kid who voluntarily went and bought this inhalant, chose to do it while driving, and ran over a lady. You have the store that directly sold it to him that's also selling drug paraphernalia, and then you have the manufacturer and distributor that sells it. What were the percentages of fault?
70% fault on United Brands, 20% fault on Coffin Cardinal, and 10% fault on Trenton Geiger.
What were the compensatory damages for your clients for the loss of their daughter?
$20 million.
What did the jury say about yes or no for punitive damages for each defendant?
Jury said each assessed punitive damages, they should be responsible, all three of them. So they should be liable.
Did the jury assess any punitive damages to Trenton Geiger in light of the fact that he was already in jail?
No.
How did his lawyer do in his closing argument?
It was unbelievable. It really struck right at the heart of the matter, which is
he's being punished.
He's not here because he's in prison and will be in prison for what he did for the rest of his life, not physically in prison, but this is something that he will live with and will have to answer for in the afterlife. He said these are his sins, and we think he's already been punished.
Did the jury assess any punitive damages to Coffin Cardinal?
Yes, $25 million.
Did the jury assess any damages to United Brands?
$700
million. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been another episode of The Jury Is Out. I'm Tim Cronin.
I'm John Simon.
I'm Johnny Simon.
We'll see you next time.
The Jury Is Out is brought to you by the Simon Law Firm. At the Simon Law Firm PC, we believe in the power of pooling resources in order to create powerful results. We often lend our trial skills and experience to lawyers around the country to achieve better results for their clients. Our attorneys welcome the opportunity to work with you on your case, offering vast resources, seasoned litigators, and a sterling reputation. You can contact us at 314-241-2929. And if you enjoyed the podcast, feel free to share your thoughts with John, Tim, and Eric at comments@thejuryisout.law. And subscribe today, because the best lawyers never stop learning.